I was saying, this is the second talk that I've given in this hall in as many days. I gave the talk here at SBMG last night. Somewhat of a challenge to come up with two original talks. And, of course, you know, some people were there, so you don't want to say the same thing over again, although that would be convenient for me. Anyway, we have a different topic for our study period this fall. We're looking at the perfection of wisdom teachings. So I'm going to continue saying something about those teachings from my limited perspective. Of course, from the perspective of the perfection of wisdom, everyone has a limited perspective. Because as Dora Lee has reminded us, the perfection of wisdom is characterized by being immeasurable, incalculable, inconceivable, incomparable, and illimitable. So, what I take away from that is the perfection of wisdom is incalculably large. And of course, when you hear analogies made to the perfection of wisdom, inevitably very large metaphors are used, like an empty space or an empty room. It's like an empty room or a large empty space, or it's like the whole universe. I think it has some correspondence also with Zuki Roshi's Big Mind. It has some correspondence with his sense of Big Mind. When I sat down tonight, I thought, well, there's also some correspondence with our practice. There's a correspondence with our practice of just sitting. When we're just sitting, there's just sitting. There's not two things. There's not a sitter. And there's not just a chair. There's not a sitter in his mind or her mind. There's just one thing, just sitting. So this just sitting has some correspondence, too, with this very large perfection of wisdom. I think before, I gave a talk on this once before, and the analogy I used was, metaphor for perfection of wisdom, which wasn't available to the people that wrote the perfection of wisdom, is that it's like a black hole in space. And the reason I say it could be, you could use that as an analogy, is because if for black holes, we can't see black holes directly. They can't be seen. They can't be seen by even our greatest astronomical instruments. Cannot see a black hole. We intuit that a black hole is there by the behavior of objects around the black hole. In other words, I think a black hole has gravity, and so, or it's theorized to have gravity. Therefore, it makes objects that are in its vicinity wobble. And when we observe the wobbling of stars or planets in the vicinity of the black hole, then the science tells us that the black hole is there. So we intuit that the black hole is there by the behavior of objects around the black hole. And so the reason, my analogy, is this is like the perfection of wisdom, because the perfection of wisdom can't be, you know, a limited being can't really see the immeasurable, incalculable, inconceivable, incomparable, and illimitable. So we intuit that the perfection of wisdom is there by the behavior of things around it. And the things that are around the perfection of wisdom are called bodhisattvas. Bodhisattvas are the objects that respond to the perfection of wisdom. I wouldn't say they wobble, but they respond, and they are present when the perfection of wisdom is present. So bodhisattvas, of course, are enlightening beings. They're disciples of Buddha, and they're on the path to Buddhahood. And really, the whole Perfection of Wisdom Sutra is about them. It's all about the bodhisattvas and what they're up to. And the main thing that they're up to, so we know that they're there circling around the perfection of wisdom because they're doing some practices. And the practice, well, one of the practices they're doing, of course, is just sitting. And the other practices that they're doing are called the six perfections. And we've talked many times in this group about the six perfections, and I hope we will talk about them many more times. The perfection of giving, the perfection of morality, the perfection of patience, the perfection of energetic application, the perfection of just sitting, meditation, and the perfection of wisdom itself. So we see that bodhisattvas are practicing these practices, and then what we're told in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra is, in a way, even though bodhisattvas are practicing these practices, they're so immersed in selflessness that they have no self-consciousness of practicing these practices. They are so immersed in these practices that the practices essentially are, that's just their activity. That's just what bodhisattvas are manifesting all the time. They're like radiating these six perfections without having any idea that they are practicing these six perfections. I'm going to get really thirsty. Wonder if somebody can get me a water. I'm not going to be able to talk pretty soon. I meant to bring my water bottle in, but I neglected to do it. So we can just practice sitting, just sitting. Thank you so much. So, for instance, we say about the bodhisattva's practice that when the bodhisattva is giving, is practicing giving, the bodhisattva doesn't see a giver. He doesn't see anybody that's receiving a gift, and she doesn't see a gift either. So there's this sort of cosmic lack of self-consciousness. Sort of this extreme lack of self-consciousness in the bodhisattva. The bodhisattva is just radiating these virtues. That's the sense that we get when we read the Perfection of Wisdom. Also, this is a quote that Dora Lee provided us with. When they're practicing the Perfection of Wisdom, their experience is like this. No wisdom can we get a hold of. No highest perfection. No bodhisattva. No thought of enlightenment either. When told of this, when a bodhisattva is told of this, if not bewildered and in no way anxious, a bodhisattva courses in the well-gone's wisdom, in the Buddha's wisdom, that is. I remember once, a long time ago, Millard said in a retreat, he said, sometimes I think I might just disappear. So, so if you had that feeling, you could have some fear around that feeling. You definitely could have some feeling that some fear would come up in that type of experience. That there, whereas one moment before you thought there was someone there doing the practice, and then all of a sudden, maybe you didn't know where that person was. So I'd like to read you a passage from my annotated version of the Prajnaparamita here. And this is, I think, I wrote one of the most beautiful passages. And I think it really is one of the most. I at one point read this entire book, but it's been a while since I did that. But I did kind of annotate it, so I'd be able to go back to what I felt were most instructive passages. So one of the things I should have mentioned, neglected to mention, that the bodhisattva is practicing these perfections, these six perfections, but is also teaching these six perfections, and that's a very important point, because the bodhisattva is working for the benefit of all beings, and that's really what makes a bodhisattva a bodhisattva. A bodhisattva is intent on the liberation, and as we chanted, in our chant, the liberation of all beings is the work of the bodhisattva. She's practicing the six perfections, and she's teaching, and she's encouraging others to practice the perfection of giving, the perfection of morality, patience, and so forth. So practicing and teaching. This is considered not such an easy thing to do, and a fellow named Shariputra in the Perfection of Wisdom asks Subhuti about this, because he thinks that this perfection of the bodhisattva's practice is a difficult practice, And so he asks Subhuti, how does a bodhisattva go on what he calls this difficult pilgrimage? How can he possibly endure the sufferings which he is said to undertake for the sake of beings? So this is Subhuti's answer. I don't seem to be moving my mouth right tonight. I do not look for a bodhisattva who goes on a difficult pilgrimage. In any case, one who courses in the perception of difficulties is not a bodhisattva. Because one who has generated a perception of difficulties is unable to work for the welfare of countless beings. On the contrary, he forms the notion of ease. He forms the notion that all beings, whether men or women, are his parents and children, and thus he goes on the pilgrimage of a bodhisattva. A bodhisattva should therefore identify all beings with his parents or children, yes, even with his own self, like this. As I myself want to be quite free from all sufferings, just so all beings want to be quite free from all sufferings. In addition, with regard to all beings, one should form the notion, I ought not to desert all these beings. I ought to set them free from the quite immeasurable heap of sufferings. And I should not produce toward them a thought of hate, even though I might be dismembered 100 times. It is thus that a bodhisattva should lift up his heart. When he dwells as one whose heart is such, then he will neither course nor dwell as one who perceives difficulties. And further, a bodhisattva should produce the thought that, as in each and every way a self does not exist and is not got at, so in each and every way all dharmas do not exist and are not got at. He should apply this notion to all dharmas inside and outside. When he dwells as one whose heart is such, then he neither will course nor dwell as one who perceives difficulties. So, one of the things that the perfection of wisdom teachings do is they look back at the description that's been made in all Buddhism prior to the authoring of the Perfection of Wisdom, and they question, the authors of the Perfection of Wisdom, question and dissect the previous analysis of dharmas, of viewing the world, not, you know, the way... Buddhism is like a successive set of deconstructions. And so the first wave of deconstruction breaks appearances into a set of dharmas. And the one, for instance, the ones that we're most familiar with are the ones that we chant in the Heart Sutra. Particularly the 5 skandhas and the 4 noble truths and the 12-fold chain of causation. All of these previous deconstructions that Buddhism has done, that Buddhism has rested on up to that point, the perfection of wisdom says no. No form, no feeling, no perception, no formations, no consciousness. So if the authors of the Perfection of Wisdom thought that their fellow Buddhists were verging on, if not had not already, attributed selfhood to the Dharmas. They had deconstructed the self, but then they now were kind of using their deconstruction as a new self. So the perfection of wisdom is coming along and saying, no, not even dharmas, not the skandhas either. You can't find a self in the dharmas, and at base, the dharmas don't exist. This is kind of the philosophical standpoint of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. Of course, in order to maintain this kind of logic, they also have to say that the perfection of wisdom also doesn't exist. Even though they're preaching the perfection of wisdom, they have to say that it doesn't exist either. It's not a real thing. It's also empty, we can't make it into a thing, and we can't develop it, and we can't construe it as a thing. We can't make it into something. So there's one more passage I want to read. It's to this point that I just made. Deep, O Lord, this is Subhuti, he's talking to the Buddha. This was written 600 years after the Buddha lived. Deep, O Lord, is perfect wisdom. It cannot be developed by anything, nor by anyone, nor is there anything or anyone to be developed. For in perfect wisdom, nothing at all has been brought to perfection. The development of perfect wisdom is like the development of space, or of all dharmas, or of non-attachment, of the infinite, of what is not, of not taking hold of the Lord. So it is. Because of what you said, a bodhisattva who adjusts himself to deep and perfect wisdom is to be regarded as irreversible from full enlightenment. For then a bodhisattva does not settle down in this deep and perfect wisdom, nor in the declarations or counsels of others. He does not go by someone else whom he puts his trust in. When this deep perfection of wisdom is being taught, he does not become cowed or stolid, nor does he turn his back on it. He will not tremble, be frightened, or terrified. He does not hesitate or doubt or get stupefied, but he plunges right into it. I love that line. He plunges right into it, becomes resolutely intent on it, and delights in its vision and hearing. One should know that in a former life, already he has explored the perfection of wisdom, because now when this deep and perfect wisdom is being taught, he does not tremble, is not frightened, nor terrified. So the perfection of wisdom, luckily for us, is beyond our conceptions of it, and it's beyond our any ideas that we can somehow, for instance, we could generate it in our meditation or something like that. That we could conjure it up. It's that's completely you know, that's the perspective of like certain, there are certain religious schools that believe that we conjure up wisdom, that we conjure up wisdom by our effort, but our school is not like that. We believe that we can participate, we can sidle up to perfect wisdom, every moment are actually participating in perfect wisdom, without anything being left out at all. We don't produce it. We don't produce it by our meditation. So this itself is very freeing kind of thinking. We simply align ourselves with perfect wisdom. That perfect wisdom is the perfection of giving, the perfection of morality, the perfection of patience, the perfection of energetic application, and so forth, perfection of meditation. And you know, to make some effort to align ourselves with that perfection that's within our wheelhouse. I mean, if we're doing something, if we think we're doing something, we can think about that alignment, but it's not like we're creating it or constructing it or conjuring it in any way. It's the sea in which we swim is the feeling that one gets from reading the sutra. It's the sea in which bodhisattvas swim, in any case. So, you know, our practice of just sitting is said by many of our great teachers to be the most appropriate approach to this alignment. And so we can sit very still, because one of the things about perfect wisdom, it really isn't moving. Perfect wisdom is silent and still. So we kind of correspond the best with perfect wisdom when we are silent and still. We're best aligned with it in that posture, in that attitude. Now, maybe we're most easily aligned with it. We can most easily see in that sitting still gesture that we are aligned with it. And then we need, you know, or then we could begin to see that we're also aligned with it when we're in our daily, going about our daily activities, when we're chopping vegetables and, you know, making dinner or going to the grocery store or just, you know, picking up a book. And, you know, how do we treat a book when we pick it up? How do we treat things? We can take this kind of carefulness that is a feature of our sitting meditation. In our sitting meditation, we have to make some effort. We have to take some care. We have to take some care of our posture. And we do make some effort in our sitting meditation. Ultimately, just sitting is the best. Just sitting. without any really. You don't really need a thought of self. You don't really need a thought of self to do sitting meditation. Well, once you've settled into your upright posture, you really have nothing more to take care of. You might have to move to, you know, adjust your knees. I've had to start sitting on a bench just recently because my knees have been complaining quite a bit. But nevertheless, once you've settled in, you really don't need to. You can drop away all your thoughts of all your concerns. If you're in a safe place like this, or in a safe place in your home, you need to be in a safe place, a nice, comfortable place, a place that's properly lit and properly quiet and so forth. But once you're in that place and you feel safe, then you sit and drop away all self-concern. And you really don't need to think about your problems or anything else. You just align yourself with the sitting itself. Just honor the sitting when you're sitting. So as I said, I gave the talk here last night, and some people thought it was okay talk. And one person sent me a poem today. They sent me a poem which I thought went right along with what I was going to talk about tonight. So I want to read you this poem. It's quite a wonderful poem, and I think it's right on the topic. It's the name of this poem is called Annunciation. Has anybody ever heard this poem? You've heard this poem? Yeah, I never heard this poem before. It's about the most wonderful poem I've ever read. It goes like this. Even if I don't see it again, nor ever feel it, I know it is. And that if once it hailed me, it ever does. And so it is myself I want to turn in that direction. Not as toward a place, but it was a tilting within myself, as one turns a mirror to flash the light where it isn't. A little like a flashing a mirror, you know, like you would catch the sun in a mirror and you would flash the light. Okay. I'll read that line again. And so it is myself I want to turn in that direction, not as toward a place. But it was a tilting within myself, as one turns a mirror to flash the light where it isn't. I was blinded like that, and swam in what shone at me, only able to endure it by being no one, and so specifically myself. I thought I'd die from being loved like that. Anyway, I'll send this poem out so you can, like, read it over a few times. Because if you read this poem over a few times, I think you will fall in love with this poem. And it's a pretty great poem. You know, dying in Zen, you know, you don't have to read it like die, like she's using to die, you know, like we'd use it almost in common speech. I thought I'd die, you know. But dying in Zen is actually, you know, the self, small self falling away, the self-concerned. So you can read this poem like that. I thought I'd die from being loved like that. It's a wonderful poem. I'll send it to everybody. I'll put it in an email or something. It's written by Marie Howe. Yeah. So that's where I expected to conclude my talk. So if you have any comments or things that you'd like to bring up based on your practice or what I've said, you're welcome to do so. Yes, Susan.
The first section, the first piece that you read out of that, is it on?
Yeah.
The first section that you read out of the
Is it sutra, working? Loud enough? Can you hold it closer?
Hello. Is that working? Okay. The first section that you read out of the book, and I'm probably not remembering, said that the bodhisattva shouldn't dwell in difficulty or something. Could you look at that again?
Well, yeah, the bodhisattva is one who doesn't dwell in a perception, doesn't go on a difficult pilgrimage.
That was it.
Yeah, doesn't go on a difficult pilgrimage. So the speaker is saying that this is, in a way, he's saying, what's difficult, what would really be difficult, is not trying to save people. This would be not trying to liberate people. What would really be difficult would just be living a very selfish, self-concerned life. And so I don't think this is a difficult period. This is a liberative pilgrimage, because you're in that pilgrimage, you're seeing other people as your son. What is it they say? This your child or your parent. You're seeing people. You're seeing your connection to other people, and when you're seeing, I think what the speaker is saying is when you're seeing how connected you are, how you're not other than other people. That's not a difficult pilgrimage. That is actually, I won't agree with you that that's a difficult pilgrimage. That's not to say that the bodhisattva path isn't a difficult pilgrimage. Oscar, I think, has a distinction, except for my long-suffering wife, of having heard all of my talks in the last 8 days or something. Thank you, Oscar.
Thank you, Jim.
For your...
They've all been quite wonderful. I agree with Ginger's assessment. I just wanted to share a feeling of gratification that I have that in your talks, I've heard quite a few things mentioned, and I was at Reb's place recently. And it's really resonating with me how Bahia's teachings to Bahia in the seeing, just the seeing, and the hearing, just the hearing, and the idea of not touching or turning away, and the idea of I am not it, in truth it is me. I appreciate more strongly than perhaps I have in the past how this is all one thing.
Hmm.
It's all just the same thing. And also it's the same as... something you mentioned about being in a safe place and not needing to really think about anything. It's okay not to think about anything right now. So that's all.
Sangha is a safe place to not think about anything. Hopefully that's what Sangha is for. It was interesting. I mean, last night I came, and it was a big crowd of people all around. There was so many people, but I don't know those people. You know, And they're not my sangha. I mean, there are still the Maha Sangha, but there's a lot of people I didn't know. But when I come here, I mean, I'm not evaluating that. I'm saying that was one thing. But coming here tonight, I feel so relaxed, so comfortable with you, and so I feel like we're. Like it's really easy to see you as my sons and parents, and because I know you, and we share this particular practice. I love that practice over there too, and we had a wonderful evening too, so it was fine. But when I sat down tonight, I felt like I can just sit here, and it's really all right. It's really good. It's really sweet. And I can really just sit here. So I appreciate that. Oh, Raphael?
What makes it easy for me whenever I sit or wherever I am is when I don't bring anything, I'm not looking for anything, I'm not leaving with anything. And conversely, when I do bring something and when I do look for something, then it's more difficult. And so I guess it's not easy, huh? Because there's so much there. So much can be here. And so for me, I really have been able to find that place where there is no windows, there is no doors. It's just an empty space.
I don't have anything to add to that. Thank you for your practice. Thank you all for your practice.